are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, April 19th, 2016. I'm Michael Brooks, pinch hitting for Sam Steeder, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Professor Anthony Pereira, director of the Brazil Institute at King's College in London, is going to join us to talk about the hidden story of what's happening in Brazil. President Dilma Rousseff impeached by the lower house there, and impeachment proceedings proceeding to the Senate in early May. But is this really just a coup pushed through the judiciary system? We'll talk about all of that with him. And of course, it is election day in New York City. Many people feeling the burn. Many people feeling the Hill. Lots of people feeling the Donald. No one feeling the Cruz. I already voted before I did an appearance this morning on Sirius XM. It was a great pleasure to vote for Bernie. President Obama is on his way to Riyadh as instability grips the Saudi state, the Saudi monarchy, and in some respects an unprecedented way. Horrific bombings in Kabul and Afghanistan leave dozens dead, hundreds injured. Get to that. And Bernie Sanders, again, has been an unmitigated positive for the process. We have more sound from him rallying the troops in Long Island City, talking about the awakening propelling his campaign, the bigger picture behind it that will carry on and endure, whether it leads him to the presidency or in any other scenario. Rudy Giuliani really backs Donald Trump, but he really wants you to know that he doesn't work for him. I wonder what's going on with that little racist guy. John Kasich really outdoing himself, just being a schmuck. It's like New York brings it out in him. And Laura Ingraham had a meltdown. See, we go from the high to the very low on this program. What's the geopolitics driving instability in Saudi Arabia? What's really happening in Brazil? The primary today in New York that will determine the future in some respects of this country. And, Laura Ingraham had a temper tantrum. Guys, there's a brand new episode of Two Dope Boys in a Podcast. Brand F-Up of the Week involves Starbucks. We talk about the collapse of Al Jazeera and the failure of having a media outlet that wasn't necessarily left or not left, but established in a different geographic zone. Center of gravity in the Southern Hemisphere versus London, New York, or DC. And then we talked about selling out, what it is and what it isn't. We have an amazing group of people around us that rotate as crew members. Hyung Kim at Madbury Club, Georgette Pierre, she is a writer, hosts a dating show called Dear Georgette, which actually I taped a couple episodes of over the weekend. Maybe I'll talk about that in the fun half. Need you to subscribe today. The best way right now to subscribe to it, and we'll put a link to it on Majority Report FM, is at iTunes. Two, Dope Boys and a Podcast. We got an awesome review on iTunes over the weekend. We got a couple of awesome reviews, and we haven't done this before, but I just wanted to highlight one because it gives you a good flavor of the show. Matt, can you give that a quick read?
Yeah, so this is from an artesian thing. Oh, wait, is this the right one?
Oh, so it's the one right above that, I think.
There's no one. There's none. So I need the podcast.
Oh, okay, that's fine. You can read that one. That was good, too.
Okay, here it is. So I need this podcast for my work as a creative. It's so smart, and on top of everything, the evil side of app dating, ghosting, why soca music is about to go global, why the middle class is disappearing, and the brand screw-up of the week. We see you, Chingy, in Whole Foods. Michael and Phil have really good rapport, and I can't wait to hear more from the crew. Now going to be a weekly listener.
Awesome. So thank you, everybody, so much for making that happen. And none of it could happen without comfortable underwear, which is why, you know, we talk about how much time you spend sleeping. You spend literally, well, not literally, hopefully, but you spend a lot of time in your underwear. I hope you have aspects
you're
of your
not
life.
You're not a never nude.
Yeah, I hope.
Pop culture
right.
reference goes.
Yeah, I hope you're not. I hope there's not an Arrested Development situation. I hope that, but I do hope that while you're in underwear, you are doing it in the most comfortable way possible, which is why I'm very happy to talk to you about our new sponsor. That is MeUndies. Whether you're wearing suits or sweats, you spend almost 24 hours a day in your underwear. But instead of making a statement like Superman's tights under his everyday clothes, your underwear is probably boring. MeUndies is here to change that. Every part of your life should have style, folks. Every pair of MeUndies is made from a sustainably sourced modal fabric that is twice as soft as cotton. Nothing can describe the fit and feel of MeUndies, but once you try them, you'll understand why they've been called the world's most comfortable underwear. And if you don't love your first pair of MeUndies, they're free. No questions asked. MeUndies have dozens of styles, limited edition prints to help you make a statement with your underwear, whether anyone can see them or not. Remember Superman. Shipping is free to the U.S. and Canada, and you can save up to $8 off a pair of MeUndies with a subscription plan. Get a subscription or a single pair and get 20% off of your first order when you go to MeUndies.com/majority. That's MeUndies.com/majority for 20% off of your first order. MeUndies.com/majority. It's a pretty awesome product. Tomorrow, if you are a member, you are going to get a breakdown of what happened in New York, brand new. That's going to be taped in Vegas with Sam Cedar and Cliff Schechter, if you are a member. If you're not a member, but you go to our website and you go scroll down to the sign-up page and you sign up for the email blast, the Cedar Reader, which you want to sign up for regardless, you will get that show. You just scroll to the bottom of the page, right, Matt?
Well, there's a bit of a mix-up. It's not the way bottom sign-up. It's the one below it. So you scroll down and see the first one.
Scroll down, see the first one. There's two. You want to go to the one, the first one that you see. Put in your email address. Subscribe to the Cedar Reader, and you will get Sam and Cliff's conversation tomorrow, recorded after the New York primary results. Also, for all of this month at justcoffee.coop, you can get 30% off of your offer with the promo code MRSpring16. That's MRSpring16. There's a link to it on our website with the promo code as well. We will be right back with Anthony Pereira. Feel the burn. Yes, I am. Wow. Feel the fire. Give me the fire, pick a burn. I said the papers turn. Give me the remedy, the fire figure blaze. Burn Babylon, dirty way. Special. Eternal fire. Dirty Babylon, you are gonna get bruised. Me, I want them fire. I said they just can't win, you're going to lose. We are want them. Ooh, yeah. I'm back up and warm. Me, I beg you move, yeah. I beg you back up and warm. Me said that movement I like.
life. Marcus Seffi organize and centralize. Rastafi own banks and enterprise. So me not stop chanting my soul enter Zion. Princes of fire, Babylon me tell you your time just expire. What kind of wickedness me a your transpire? And no gasoline and a tire. Eternal fire. Dirty Babylon, you will go get bruised. Me a want them fire. I said they just can't win, you're going to lose. We a want them. Ooh, yeah. Ooh, yeah. I beg your papa one one. I tell the pack up and burn. Where them a go with a key and salt fish wing? Better them give me a key and garlic. That's right. Pass me a map and a compass on ya. Make me show them say salt fish no come from on ya. The fish they come a far away. They bring him on the way.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I am Michael Brooks, and joining us now is Professor Anthony Pereira. He is the director of the Brazil Institute at King's College, London. Professor, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Michael.
So wanted to speak with you about this unfolding crisis in Brazil. There is a pretty sort of broad narrative to this that you see in, you know, the American press, and actually apparently emanating from a lot of the Brazilian press, that this is a simple question of corruption, civil society uprising. It seems to be a bit more complicated than that, but in order to situate the conversation, can you help anchor us in understanding who these two figures are? That's Lula, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, President Dilma Rousseff. He was the former president, and he's the founder of the Workers' Party, which they are both members of. Take us into their history, maybe starting with Lula.
Right. Yeah, these two figures, Lula and Dilma, in a way represent two of the most important forces in the Workers' Party. It was formed at the end of the 1970s, and one anchor of it was the trade union movement. So the trade union movement in the ABC region, the auto, mostly auto workers, had some strikes in 1979 that really defied the military dictatorship. Brazil had a dictatorship from 64 to 79, sorry, to 85. And Lula, as the leader of the auto workers in that region, emerged as one of the key leaders of the opposition to the military dictatorship. So he became president of the party early on. He was always the most important leader. He ran for president in 89, 94, 98, and finally won presidency in 2002. Dilma comes out of the armed left because mm-hmm. there were some mostly young people, mostly students, who decided in the late 60s, when the regime got much more repressive and cracked down, they decided to take up arms. And so there were lots of kind of splinter left groups. The Communist Party was actually not in favor of armed action against the dictatorship. And a lot of them were very severely dealt with. So Dilma herself was arrested, tortured quite badly, and ended up 3 years as a prisoner. And so those two forces came together in the late 70s, early 80s. And they were also joined by people who were influenced by liberation theology. Mm-hmm. And the Workers' Party also attracted a lot of middle-class intellectuals, people from the universities, people from the public sector. And it was a really small party at the beginning. And in fact, a lot of its features were that it was more of a sort of conglomeration of social movements mm-hmm. than it was an actual political party. And there was a really interesting internal debate in the party in the 1980s of how much like a professional party they should become. But they did become a very professionalized party. They started winning a lot of mayorships, a lot of governorships. And as I said, they got the presidency in 2002. Lula's administration started in 2003, and they've now had they've been the major party in a coalition government at the national level for 14 years. So part of what this is about is getting the Workers' Party out of that position.
Absolutely, and we'll certainly get to that. But to underlie this history, it actually reminds me in some ways, and correct me if I'm wrong, but there was a debate in the 80s in European, particularly German Green Party, between the kind of relos or fundies, and that similar kind of debate, or are we sort of a political party that organizes activists, or do we want to actually take and assume power? And Lula, I believe, ran for presidency, the presidency of Brazil, three times before winning in 2002. What did he have to do, both in terms of the kind of practical mechanisms inside the Workers' Party and in terms of his broader image, just even from a PR perspective for the public or from a policy perspective, his commitments on macroeconomic policy to get there on the fourth try?
That's a great question, because that is a pivotal moment in the history of the party. As you said, it had a kind of Green Party social movement feel to it for a long time, and it was always internally quite democratic and very programmatic and ideological. It was not into the kind of trading of favors that's common in other parties in Brazil at that time in its history. After Lula lost the third time in 98, he went to the party and he said, I will be willing to run again, but I need to have more control over the campaign. It's going to be a Lula campaign and not a PT campaign. And the party conceded to that request, and he ran in 2002 with a conservative sort of center-right vice presidential candidate from the Liberal Party, who was actually evangelical. He made a broad coalition. He wrote a letter to the Brazilian people in the summer of 2002, in which he said that he would respect contracts and he would respect the debt that Brazil had at that time with the IMF. So he sort of accepted the macroeconomic framework that existed at that time, which was quite neoliberal, and he ran on a much broader coalition, and he changed his image. He talked about peace and love. He had nicely tailored suits. He trimmed his beard. He looked a lot more. He looked a lot less threatening,
less militant, more cuddly.
Exactly. He became cuddly. Became kind of avuncular. Softened his tone, and so he won in 2002. And I would say between 2002 and then 2006, when he gets reelected, he actually also shared the spoils of governance more. He brought in the PMDB to a greater extent. That's the kind of center-right party that's now against Dilma Rousseff, but they were his allies at that point. And I think one of the really interesting things that happens between the 2002 and 2006 election is that Lula loses a lot of his middle-class support. Between 2002 and 2006, partly because his economic policies were trying to target the poor. The rich were doing very well, the poor were doing quite well, and the middle class wasn't really getting that much. So they abandoned him to quite a large extent. But he picks up the unorganized poor, the people who are really on low incomes, and that's more than compensates for his loss of middle class support, but it's a very different sort of base of support for Worker Party presidents since the 2006 election. And you can pretty much go down the income scale. As you go down in income, you're more likely to find people who vote for PT presidential candidates.
Because there's no doubt, just as an addendum, that it seems very clearly established that, you know, regardless of any, you know, decisions or corruption or anything else, both the administrations of Lula and Dilma have certainly delivered in some ways for the extreme poor. Like, that support from the poor is not just symbolic. It's been very real. It's been real delivery that's made a difference in income, food security, and everything else. That has been a very successful and real part of both of their records, and probably particularly Lula. So what strikes me, though, as you say this, and which is fascinating, and I want you to kind of use this question to lead us into the present accusations and present crisis. But in the Western press, or not the, in the American press, the European press, when Lula was first kind of emerging on the stage, and through, like, as you say, his first term, and then there was a kind of broad period, I think, you know, Lula left office as probably the most popular politician in the world who actually faces democratic accountability. He was extraordinarily popular. Right. There was this idea that, you know, that was always reported that, you know, he started on the hard left and now he's, you know, he's kind of, you know, he's center leftish. He's kind of a social democrat. People even compared him to sort of the Tony Blair, Bill Clinton vein, which I think is a stretch, to be fair to Lula, frankly. Yeah. But what struck me, especially as this scandal has kind of unfolded, was that part of quote unquote moderating in Brazilian politics is making peace and alliances with systemic corruption. So
right.
In a certain sense, it's this inversion now where, oh, all of a sudden, you know, Lula and Dilma have been so corrupt, supposedly, but accepting and acquiescing to a certain degree of that was part and parcel of the first moderation image, which everybody wanted to praise him for. So if you could kind of riff on that and then use that to open up what's happening now, that would be great.
Sure. I mean, I think what you bring up is a really important point, and it's why that there are, you know, there are people on the left in Brazil who feel really let down by the Workers' Party, who thought that the Workers' Party, because it was at least in opposition, principled and ethical and talked about transforming Brazil and transforming the traditional corrupt way of doing politics in Brazil, you know, they feel let down because rather than the PT really changing the political system, they were in fact changed by it, and they became more like all those other politicians and parties that they criticized when they were in opposition. But in some ways, you know, I think it was, and I think Lula has a lot to do with this. Lula was never really highly ideological. He wasn't someone who was steeped in the history of the labor movement, for example, or about socialism. He was a very pragmatic negotiator. He was a good negotiator. He would get good deals for his members. And I think that was, he was always that kind of trade union leader who would talk to everybody and seek a consensus.
Right.
And he had around him when he was elected in 2002 a team of people like José Dirceu, who was his chief of staff, and Palocci, who was his finance minister, who were also extremely powerful, extremely pragmatic, and oriented towards power. And they realized, you know, we have to have, we can maintain party discipline and we can be focused on program, but we know that all of these other parties are not.
Right.
And so we're going to have to play ball with them, and we're going to have to give them parts of the federal budget. We're going to have to give them ministries. And of course, you know, I think there's pretty compelling evidence that they got involved in the same sorts of corruption that other parties and politicians have been involved in. So in a way, it was the price that they felt, I think, that they were willing to pay to change Brazil and to do some of the things that they did, which was, for example, this conditional cash transfer program, which lifted people out of poverty, the you know, increasing access to university and technical education through a really big loan program loan and grant program to low-income students, affirmative action in the universities, trying to promote gender equality, all of these things. So, you know, in their minds, I think, these pragmatic compromises were what they needed to do to deal with the reality of the Brazilian political system.
What are some of the specifics of some of these corruption allegations targeting Dilma and Lula, and how has the judiciary, it seems, again, like there's probably some legitimacy to some of these charges, and if you could, you know, outline them, that would be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
you know, it does seem at the very least that, as an example, you know, leaking conversations that are part of an investigation between Lula and Dilma in an effort to embarrass them is, you know, at the very least questionable.
Exactly.
And even as, you know, they have been targeted, all of the major political parties are implicated in this. So, you know, I guess
exactly.
play out that contradiction there.
Well, you're absolutely right. You know, we saw this spectacle on Sunday of the members of the lower house voting to impeach Dilma. And the guy presiding over that session was Eduardo Cunha, who's been charged by the attorney general of receiving a $5 million bribe to get a company, a contract from Petrobras, the state-owned oil company, and of also having undeclared bank accounts in Swiss banks with millions of dollars in them. So,
right.
you know, this is not a spectacle in which clean politicians are impeaching a corrupt one. There's, you know, corruption is endemic in Congress. What the car wash investigations have revealed, an investigation led by a judge called Sergio Moro in Curitiba, what they found was that, and what they're alleging is that big that had contracts with Petrobras would routinely over invoice or over bill for those contracts. The kickbacks would then go to executives in the oil company, but they would also be funneled to politicians for campaigns. And if you read the Brazilian press, you'd be forgiven for thinking PT was the only party benefiting from this scheme. But this was a very, very widespread scheme and involved a lot of parties in the coalition.
A professor? Professor?
About 50 people.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Have you moved or anything? Because your connection was excellent, and we've just gotten a bit choppy.
Okay, I think I moved away from the mic there.
Sorry. Oh, yes. Get back to the mic, please. Thank you.
Is that better?
That's significantly better. Yes, great.
Okay.
Go right ahead.
So there's about 50 Congress who have been implicated in this car wash investigation in this kickback scheme, and that includes Edmund of the lower house. It includes Michelle Temer. The thing is, Dilma, there's no evidence that is produced yet that Dilma, you know, benefited from any of this corruption, but right. She was chairman of the board on Petrobras during Lula's second term. So, you know, what her critics allege is that there's a sin of omission, if not commission, in terms of her role in Petrobras, an oil company. But that's not actually the subject of the impeachment charge.
Yeah, what exactly, because that's the other kind of odd thing about it with regards to Dilma, what is the impeachment charge against her, and how does she sort of get dragged into what, as you already outlined, first of all the parties are implicated. Mm-hmm. In fact, it seems on the face of it, and again, not to, you know, obviously I sort of have a personal soft spot for Lula, that's clear, and I have a kind of more general sympathy to the Workers' Party. But, you know, the evidence against Lula might be there, but it's certainly more tenuous than it is for many other leading players in this, where it seems a lot more clear in terms of, you know, money in accounts and things actually moved. But with Dilma, it seems like,
I mean,
there's literally nothing there. It's just, you know, it's as if they got the Republicans had the votes together to just impeach Obama because they don't like him.
Yeah, I think it's not a very robust case. You do get constitutional lawyers saying that this is an impeachable offense. But just to point out how paradoxical the whole thing is, you know, she's accused of signing orders that delay payment banks so that the fiscal deficit looked lower than it actually was. This is something, these same orders have been signed by Michelle Temer, the vice president, who's scheduled to take over from her as an interim president once the Senate accepts these impeachment proceedings. So I think it looks like a double standard. It looks like selective invocation of the law. And in fact, these are common practices in mayorships and governorships. They've been done by previous presidents. The jurisprudence that declares that these are unconstitutional acts is very recent. And we have to remember, too, in November of 2014, right after her reelection, there were people calling for impeachment then.
Right.
They didn't have a reason for it. They just were upset that she had won reelection. And this was the fourth consecutive Workers' Party presidential victory. So I think it was something that was convenient. And what was noticeable about the Sunday vote in the lower house is that almost nobody voting yes mentioned these pedaladas, as they're called, or these sort of creative bookkeeping acts of Dilma. They talked about the Petrobras corruption. They talked about morality. They talked about their families. They talked about, how the country was ungovernable and how the economy had to improve. I mean, it was so diffuse that everything was invoked almost, very rarely the actual impeachment charges were mentioned.
Well, that's actually brings me to a couple of interconnected things here too, because as I say, Lula left office, I believe it was in 2012 or 2010. I don't remember the specific year.
2010. Yeah.
2010. Yeah. And he left, as I say, as with one of the most, I think, the highest approval rating of anybody in the world who was actually, you know, he wasn't Gaddafi, right? Like, these were real polls. Right. Everybody loved him. He was incredibly popular. And, you know, Dilma, who has this fascinating personal background, but did not have an electoral political background, he kind of handpicked her. She didn't have the same kind of charisma that he had, but she's obviously, you know, very smart, very capable. And with his stamp of approval, she was elected and then reelected on her own merits in 2014. And so it seems like, you know, one track that's happened here is that the Brazilian economy has just stalled, and that always creates general anger. So that's kind of So those tracks of, okay, we don't have a president who's as charismatic or persuasive. The economy stalled. And then the third track seems to be that, you know, the level of opposition from the media to the opposition parties to the judiciary seems to kind of, you know, it sort of seems to indicate we could never win. It looks like Lula might run again in 2018. We're not, like, we just have to stop them somehow. And Lula, ironically, for a guy who, you know, really moderated to get himself where he was and with all that entailed, you know, he's out speaking to the international press saying, like, look, this is a kind of old style Latin American coup. And almost as if the lesson after all of this time in power, and even in today's modern circumstances, that the old oligarchic dynamics are still at play, and even a moderation, as much as the Workers' Party and the delivery across sectors, is still not going to work, because fundamentally the elites don't want us to govern. And that seems like what the fault lines have turned into.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the contrast between the really rough time that Dilma's having and the much easier time that Lula had, I think it's based on three limitations of Workers' Party rule. I guess the fourth could be there is misogyny in society as well. Sure. I think that's a factor that plays against Dilma in the same way that it plays against Hillary Clinton, say, in this system. But the three limitations are, one is that I think Lula personalized the party in a way that probably wasn't healthy. So rather than a competitive election inside the party, what you had in 2010 was him as this very popular president saying, I'm going to pick this woman who's my chief of staff, who's never won an election to anything, and she's going to be my successor. And I think that sort of went against the tradition of the Workers' Party, which was to be programmatic, to be internally democratic, and you know, to be more about to be a party that was kind of bigger than any individual in it. So people started talking in 2010 about Lulismo or Lulaism, as opposed to PTism or the worker. So the person started to become more important than the party, and that's a limitation, I think. And you can see it in the lack of other candidates. So Lula's the only plausible candidate for them in 2018. The second limitation, I think, is that they did help the poor, but they helped the poor mostly through mechanisms that increase the purchasing power of the poor. So increasing access to credit, the social transfers. So you got a social income if you were really poor, access to training and education that lowered the skills gap in the labor market. What they weren't able to do as much is structurally transform the country. So, for example, improve the quality of education, improve the quality of healthcare, provide good public transportation. So as the purchasing power was going up amongst the lower income, and you got the growth of what the Brazilians call class C, between sort of 1,000 and 4,000 reais. They call it a middle class, but it's really, we probably understand it as a working class. You didn't get the corresponding improvements in public goods that would have made people's lives better. So you had more people buying cars and worse traffic. You had crime was bad because public security wasn't keeping up with the rates of crime. You had sort of unlivable situations for a lot of commuters in cities. And that was a big limitation. And I think the final limitation is that when they went in 2006 and they set that pattern of getting most of their votes from the low income, it worked electorally, but what it meant was a lot of the shapers of opinion in institutions like the judiciary, in institutions like the media, to a lesser extent in universities. There's still a lot of supporters of the Workers' Party in universities. But outside of that, most middle-class people are anti-Workers' Party. It set a dynamic in which they could win elections, but they didn't have a big cross-class coalition that could make the case for their legitimacy throughout the whole society. And you got this polarization. And you know, if you're depending mostly on the bottom half of the income distribution, you can win the votes. When it comes time to debates like these things about the impeachment, the loudest voices in these discussions are often the anti-Workers' Party voices. And you've got an electorate in Brazil, 60% of the people don't identify with any party. And the Workers' Party has the highest party identification in the electorate, but it's only about 10-11%, and it's probably that's, you know, a little while ago, it's probably fallen since then. And they have to deal with a Congress which has about 28 different parties. I think that lack of a cross-class coalition is really, in terms of their electoral support, means that they're constantly getting hammered by the media, by the mainstream media. And I think the judiciary as well has been, as you point out, with these leaks, it's been highly selective in the information that it's leaked. And it's tended to target the Workers' Party, even though the corruption is much more generalized and systematic.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, as we move towards the final sort of question here, but just to underlie that, it seems like in these two sort of failings of the Workers' Party, and again, I mean, obviously, there's a major problem in terms of the way the judiciary, other political parties, and the media have acted and are acting. I think arguably they're seriously undermining the democratic credibility of Brazil in some respects. But it's very interesting that in the failures to kind of keep a broad-based coalition, and then in the kind of failures to address more structural deficits,
mm-hmm.
there isn't the kind of structural integrity. Like, there's people's lives are better, which you can never underestimate, but there isn't.
Sure.
It's like, you know, as because Dilma's had to do austerity, and then, you know,
right.
And when you cleaned up, we did a report on what happened during the World Cup, and you know, certainly the Workers' Party government was quite, you know, brutal in enforcing the edicts of you know, the World Cup, and that's contradictory on every level of the kind of traditional Worker Party ethos. So
right.
By not doing those kind of deeper, more durable jobs, ironically, that wasn't pragmatic because it set the stage for its own crisis in a certain way.
Absolutely. And, you know, one way to look at this impeachment, and it doesn't jive with the sort of gulp or coup rhetoric, is that this is an inside job. Mm. This is the PT's own coalition partner, the PMDB, deciding to dump them and to get rid of the president. And they're doing it very well because the PT has been so dependent on these guys. It's a bit like House of Cards. You know, Michel Temer, the vice president, is leading the coalition in the lower house to vote against his own president. But I think you could fault the Workers' Party on environmental issues right. and indigenous issues as well. When you saw how the Dilma Rousseff government reacted to the Belo Monte controversy, the mm-hmm. big dam in the Amazon, you know, and these structural transformations are hard. I mean, they would, for example, they could have tried to change the tax system. You know, Brazilians, the overall level of taxation in the economy is high, but the highest tax rate is 27%. There's very little taxation of wealth, land and property. They could have tried to take that on. You know, they could have tried structural reforms. Those were difficult to do. And I suppose you could say that they're paying the price for that in a way. I mean, under Lula, it was very significant that not only poverty decreased, but income inequality, as measured by the Gini coefficient, came down. And that was really significant because that hadn't happened in a long time in Brazil. And Brazil is still one of the most unequal countries in the world when it comes to the distribution of income. But what did not get looked at during that period was, of course, inequality of wealth. And this is why Thomas Piketty's book is very relevant to Brazil, because wealth inequality, I mean, we don't really know, we don't really have the statistics, but wealth inequality may well be greater even than income inequality. And there are lots of ways for the wealthy to hang on to their wealth in Brazil. And, you know, that was something that the Workers' Party just wasn't able or willing to take on. And I think that's where a really interesting debate on the left is happening, is sort of what could the Workers' Party have done that they didn't do? How much allowance do you have to give for the realities of the Brazilian political system? And I think there are some people who are a little bit starry-eyed who say that the Workers' Party could have absolutely transformed Brazil. And we have to remember, Lula got something like 60% of the vote typically in his two elections for president in the second round. His party never got more than about 30% of the vote. Mm-hmm. So they were coming into Congress where they had maybe 20% of the seats in both houses, and they had to transform those 20% into a majority in the Congress. That's how difficult the system is.
Right.
So I think you do have to make some allowances for how that system works.
Absolutely. I mean, and as a final question, and this is the sort of, you know, generic, impossible to answer question, but take it in any direction you want to take it in. You know, what's the sort of general, what happens next from, you know, the most kind of immediate to even the relevancy of that conversation inside the left in Brazil? I mean, you know, whatever mm-hmm. you think is most relevant in terms of what's going to kind of come out of this.
Sure. Yeah, I watched that vote on Sunday, and there was a kind of climate of a big party, you know, when the 342nd deputy voted to impeach. There's this sense that this is it's going to be a big change in Brazilian politics. I think it's just one little step and an unfolding drama. It's not going to be easy for any government right now in Brazil to govern, whether it's led by Dilma Rousseff or Michel Temer, because the country is so polarized. And it's also paralyzed. The government isn't able to do the kinds of reforms that it needs to do to get out of recession. Now, you're looking at maybe a second year in a row where the economy contracts by almost 4%. This is a big crisis for Brazil. But I think in some ways it wouldn't be terrible from the point of view of the left and the Workers' Party. They're not the same thing, but to go out of power at this point, to not have their president in, because they could rethink what their values are. They could prepare to run as an opposition party in 2018, and they could sort of have the kind of moment that the Labour Party's been having here in Britain with Jeremy Corbyn as its leader. Mm. You know, Corbyn is not really a plausible prime minister, I don't think, in anybody's mind, but he's brought in a huge sort of grassroots resurgence of people joining the party and remembering what they were really all, you know, what they were interested in before Blair and New Labour sort of made them a kind of copy of the Conservatives. So I think that it wouldn't be entirely unhealthy for the Workers' Party to be out and to sort of rejuvenate itself, but then also for a really ample debate to happen, because it's not clear that the party is going to stay together. You may have people saying, well, you've already had a lot of defections, but you may have more, especially after the municipal elections that are coming up in October. You may have people like Tarso Genro from Rio Grande do Sul saying, this party, it's not going to work anymore as a vehicle for our aspirations. We have to found something else. So that could happen.
Fascinating. Professor Anthony Pereira, I appreciate your time immensely. And Professor Pereira is the director of the Brazil Institute at King's College in London. Thank you so much, Professor. I hope we have a chance to talk again sometime soon and kind of continue following what's happening even beyond the crisis point.
Thanks a lot, Michael.
Thank you. Okay, everybody. We are going to get to the fun half of the program where you can join us at 646-257-3920. Excuse me, something going on with the computer. 646-257-3920. JustCoffee.coop this month. Get 30% off with promo code MRSpring16. One word, MRSpring16. We've got a lot for you in the fun half. So catch us there. 646-257-3920. The IMs are open. Majority Report kickback, become a member. All of the good things. It's really fantastic. Say to